Since I have the time, I'd like to read a couple of quotes that are shared in A Very Convenient Warming, a book written by renowned geologist and executive director of the U.S. CO2 Coalition, Gregory Wrightstone. First quote is from Michael Crichton. There is no such thing as consensus science. If it's consensus, it isn't science. And if it's science, it's not consensus. And from Bertrand Russell, the fact that an opinion has been widely held is no evidence whatever that it is not utterly absurd. Indeed, in view of the silliness of the majority of mankind, a widespread belief is more likely to be foolish than sensible. Okay, now because I wanted to hear more about CO2, I contacted Greg. I hope we all, including climate change enthusiasts, can learn something, or at least listen and have a thought or two. I'm Robin with Tributaries. Greg, would you briefly tell us about your career as a geologist and how you came onto the road of CO2 and where it's led you today?
Yeah, my career as a geologist was, for the most part, spent as an exploration geologist and development geologist in natural gas. I was the co-author of the first comprehensive paper on the Marcellus Shale of the eastern United States, which turns out to be the largest natural gas field in the world by far. During our research, we looked at the top 10 conventional natural gas fields in the world. And those top 10 combined didn't even equal what the Marcellus was. So we've got vast quantities of natural gas in this country. And then about 8 years ago, I've always been interested in dabbling with climate change science. I knew that some of what we were being told about climate change was just incorrect. As a geologist, for example, I knew that we're being told the oceans are acidifying. But as a geologist, I know that never occurred in the past, even when carbon dioxide levels were 20 times what they are today. I knew they were wrong about that one fact, and I suspected other things were wrong, and that led me into my own exploration for the truth. And as I got into it and researched it, frankly, I was angered by what I found as a scientist. I found that there are people out there, scientists, that are deliberately spreading misinformation in order to create this climate of fear. And they've done very well at it. It's our job here, and my job as a scientist, to expose this. What I found, my latest book really is an evolution for me away from, there is no climate crisis, which there isn't, but we've gone farther now, and we see that modest warming and more carbon dioxide are leading to ecosystems that are thriving and prospering, and that's benefiting humanity.
Yes.
So we should celebrate more CO2, not add less.
Yes, and I really do not want to get into the politics of everything, so we're not going to debate. I'm just going to rely on you, Greg, for some straight-out scientific facts, and you certainly have an extremely broad view of history of the world, and we're not just talking a few hundred years. You've looked into a lot of the research throughout time. And first, can we just get very basic here to start by having you share why CO2 is called the gas of life?
Well, we call it the miracle molecule. The percentage is extremely small. We have trace gases, and it's one of those trace gases. It comprises only 0.04% of the atmosphere. That would be 420 parts per million. It's very small, but it's vital for photosynthesis to occur. You need three things. You need water, sunlight, and carbon dioxide. And the more CO2, the better, because plants will thrive on that. We're seeing this increase of carbon dioxide. It's just turbocharging plant growth. We talk about a greening of the planet. It's been well documented. There's no disagreement that more CO2 is causing a huge increase in vegetation. And going along with that, the increase in CO2 is fueling crop growth. We see the crops are breaking records year after year after year in all the countries of the earth, from the coldest to the hottest. Even in India, It's also the increase in temperature is tremendous for vegetation. The increase in temperature means we have extended growing seasons. For example, in the continental U.S., growing season has been extended by more than 2 weeks since 1900. And that's huge for the agricultural sector. It means you get more plantings in. Killing frosts stop earlier in the spring and arrive later in the fall. And so this combination of warming, more CO2, this mad dash and lower CO2 levels would just be incredibly harmful to the planet and our food production. We've recently completed an article I wrote with Dr. William Papper and Richard Lindzen. In it, we predict if they go through with this, a reduction in CO2, it would likely lead to millions of deaths, and it would directly lead to famine. It's just completely opposite of what we're being told. We're being told that carbon dioxide is the devil molecule. And again, we call it the miracle molecule because actually our unofficial motto here at the CO2 Coalition is we love CO2 and so should you.
Right. Well, let's talk about some of the ways CO2 works on the planet. We don't have time, obviously, to go through the length of history and the cooling and warming trends of the entire history of the world. But perhaps you can briefly outline the years since what's called the Little Ice Age and where we are today in a cooling or warming cycle, and then bring in those levels of CO2.
Yeah, in my new book, A Very Convenient Warming, I have an entire section devoted to the strong relationship between the rise and fall of temperature and the rise and fall of civilizations and empires. And each of the previous warm periods, the Minoan warm period, which was also the Bronze Age, the Roman warm period was a warm period, the medieval warm period, all of those warming trends and periods were hugely beneficial. Life was good. Food was bountiful. But when it started getting cold, what was repeated was crop failure, famine, pestilence, and mass depopulation during the cold periods. We are in a warming trend, thankfully, right now. It's been warming for more than 300 years. So bear in mind, the first 250 years of that warming trend that we're in had to have been entirely natural. We started adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere in significant amounts in that post-World War II economic boom. So mid-20th century is really when we started emitting lots of atmospheric CO2 levels, started increasing significantly. And what we see, for example, you talk about the Little Ice Age, probably the coldest period of the last 10,000 years. That went from AD 1250 to AD 1850. We know it was really, really cold worldwide. And again, it was associated with mass depopulation on a global scale. So maybe a third of the population of the Earth perished during that time. For example, I'm talking to you from Arlington, Virginia right now. 18 miles south of here, Georgia, Martha Washington lived at Mount Vernon. Martha loved to have ice in her summer drinks. And so George constructed a well. It was actually his ice house. And he would have his servants and enslaved servants go down to the Potomac River and cut every winter it froze thick ice. Well, that doesn't happen today. So we can take these historical records like George Washington cutting thick ice on the Potomac. The last time that happened was some 20 years ago. And it wasn't nearly as thick as what George had. But we know just using things like that, people can understand it had to have been a lot colder then. Or, for example, the previous periods, the Minoan warm period, they were growing a crop called millet in Scandinavia. Well, you can't grow millet except in subtropical and tropical areas. So you look at that and say, wow, it had to have been a lot warmer. Or during the last warm period, of course, the Vikings were on Greenland. We know it's warm there, again, from history, because they were growing barley. They used it for food and for brewing their beer. But you can't grow barley on Greenland today. Its growing seasons aren't long enough. Again, I love this association of history. And, oh, by the way, before climate science became politicized, they used to call those warm periods climate optima. And they would call it climate optima for a very good reason. It's because humanity and the human condition benefited from those warm periods.
Yes, well, it's very interesting, isn't it, how we can look at history from so many vantage points. Like you write in your book that Wolfgang Berlinger wrote a book called A Cultural History of Climate, and that talks about cooling resulting in major social upheavals. And it's certainly been known that, I believe, before the 1800s, CO2 would rise and the crops and growing seasons, as you mentioned, do start really taking off. And I'm wondering right now if you would talk a little bit about how does it work with photosynthesis and crop growth? What is the mechanism of that with CO2?
Well, CO2 is vitally important. Without it, we would have no vegetation, no crops. And because of it, there would be no life on Earth as we know it. We could not survive. So the plants bring in carbon dioxide through their pores, through the stomata. They combine that with water and sunlight in the process of photosynthesis. And we're actually CO2 impoverished. So the plants evolved when carbon dioxide levels were 2,500 parts per million, six times what it is today. So these plants, they crave more carbon dioxide, and they respond very, very well to increases in CO2.
So what would the levels, is there a reliable historical evidence for establishing what the levels were perhaps back on our planet when the plants
sure.
we rely on today were getting established?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and we have very good, and what I say accurate, pretty accurate level of records of what carbon dioxide was, going back 800,000 years from ice cores from Antarctica and Greenland, where the atmospheric gases were trapped in bubbles in the ice and then incorporated. So we can get back, we can actually look at what it was going back as much as 800,000 years to find that there were temperature changes which drove carbon dioxide changes, because cooling oceans absorb much more CO2. When it's warming oceans, they expel CO2. And we can do that little simple experiment, pull out a cold liter jar of ginger ale out of your refrigerator and open it, and it just barely just goes when you open it. Now take that liter jar and put it on your picnic table in the sun in the backyard in August and open it up. And what do you find? It's like a volcano coming out, and that's because the warmer liquids expel CO2. So it's completely opposite of what we're being told. Historically, CO2 changes have trailed temperature, but that's changed now with us increasing and emitting so much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. The 50% increase in CO2 we've recognized since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution is due to us. It is. And it's due mostly to fossil fuel emissions from the burning of fossil fuels. Maybe 6% is from cement manufacture, but nonetheless, it's human emissions that are causing this increase in CO2, and that's a good thing, again, because it's driving plant and crop growth.
Okay, well, I guess I want to say I'm not a fan of the pollution that people have to breathe with all of the cars and everything, so is it part and parcel?
I think that's different.
Yes,
carbon dioxide is not pollution. And you should be glad to know, and I'm sure you are aware, that our air and our water are probably as clean as they've been in hundreds of years today. And they're getting slightly better every year. In the United States in particular, if you look at the top 8 pollutants, if you go to EPA, if you just Google EPA and pollution, you can come to their page, and they show the 8 top pollutants and what they've done over the last, I think their page goes back to maybe 1970, and we just see a significant decrease. Carbon dioxide, though, is not a pollutant. It's only until you get up to about 8,000 parts per million, or 20 times what it is today,
right?
Could we start seeing any deleterious effect from too much CO2.
Now, take our use of fossil fuels and all of that out of the picture right now, just to speak about the Earth having its own fail-safes. We've been going through warming and cooling periods since time immemorial. So there are things like volcanoes that happen that start rising rates of CO2. And how do you see the fail-safes in the Earth itself?
Well, there's some misinformation out there about volcanoes and carbon dioxide. There's a meme that's running around that whenever Mount Pinatubo erupted, that it put more CO2 within a few days into the atmosphere than all of man's emissions since the beginning of time. It's just false. And in my book, I capture, we know pretty well how much CO2 Mount Pinatubo put into the atmosphere, and we know very closely what our emissions are. And that year that it erupted, the amount of CO2 that volcano, one of the largest of the last 100 years, put out, I believe it's less than 0.5% in that year of what man's CO2 emissions were. Particularly during the Little Ice Age most recently, we know it was exacerbated by several large, they were actually Icelandic volcanoes. Hekla, for example, erupted twice over the last several thousand years, and each time the volcanic eruption was associated with crop failures and increased cooling of the earth. And that's because the particulates, but it's mainly the sulfates, the aerosols that the volcano emits, gets up into the stratosphere. Hekla, when it last erupted big time, caused 4 to 5 years of cooling, and it was just terrible cooling across mainly the northern hemisphere that led to even worse crop failure than what they were experiencing from during the Little Ice Age. So what we see is the explosive volcanic eruptions tend to have a cooling effect.
Yes.
And are significantly bad because it blocks sunlight as well.
Yes.
And so, you take away sunlight, you make it colder. All those things combined are bad for agricultural production. The really big, for example, the last 800,000 years, there have been a series of 8 glacial advances. And between those, we have these interglacial periods like we're in today. And it's pretty well accepted that they're dominated and caused by what are called the Milankovitch cycles, which have to do with astronomical forces, has to do with the wobble of the Earth, the eccentricity of the Earth's orbit. Those are things driving these big glacial advances and retreats.
Yes.
Over the last 10,000 years, though, it's not entirely clear what's causing the warming and cooling over the last 10,000 years. Because the last 10,000 years, bear in mind, it's called the Holocene. It's the period of time since the last glacial advance ended and it retreated. So it's now 10,000-year-long interglacial period that will be coming to an end at some point in the future.
So where do you find your data on worldwide crop yields, and what have we been able to see through the imaging done by NASA?
The data comes from various reputable sources. One of those is the UN's Food and Agricultural Organization, UNFAO. I get data there. We've gotten data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, a number of different sources. One of my research associates is doing a study on India, and he's getting their government data from India. And so even one of the warmest nations on Earth is seen to be profiting from this increase in CO2 and modest rise of temperature. Again, it's a good thing that we should celebrate warming and more CO2. Because we're seeing from the coldest nations to the warmest, there's just tremendous increase in vegetation, agricultural output.
Yes, well, I love the visual of the forests marching northwards. Where is there evidence of that going on?
Dr. Timothy Ball looked at the boreal forests of Canada. And in the last 100 years, well, this was written 15 years ago, but he recognized that the tree line in Canada has marched northward some 100 kilometers because it's warming. There's a great increase of the tree line, both in the high latitudes and high altitudes. So with apologies to Jimmy Buffett, it's about changes in latitudes, changes in altitudes. And so we're seeing tree lines going farther up the mountains and farther north in the northern hemisphere and farther south in the southern hemisphere. Most of the earth, of the land of the earth, is in the northern hemisphere. Very little, relatively small amount, is in the southern hemisphere.
Sure. And one thing we didn't really speak about is about water and plants and higher CO2 levels and the fact that plants are able to hold more water, which has a definite effect on their growth and drought.
Exactly. Because plants, it's called transpiration, this breathing in and out, if you will, by the plants. And when they expel oxygen, they bring in CO2, photosynthesis converts it to glucose and oxygen. They expel that. When they expel it, water vapor goes out the stomata or pores as well. Because of more CO2, they don't have to have as high transpiration rates. And because of that, they lose less water. And what that does, there's been a great increase in their ability to withstand drought, is the increase of CO2 is adding to the drought resistance of plants. It's very little talked about, but it's an important factor. Another good factor of why we should celebrate CO2 and its great benefits. We've got drought resistance. Crop growth is accelerating. And all these things are leading to benefits to the human condition.
Yes, there's definitely no separation between plant health and human health. Craig, you wrote in your book that the author W. Cleon Scouser called this rapid advancement in the last 150 years the 5,000-year leap. And there was an American author and futurist named Robert Anton Wilson who called it the jumping Jesus phenomenon. Everything is so interlinked, where we have more CO2, and it just depends where you look in history or what your focus is, because as we have longer growing seasons, et cetera, that we've just been speaking about, that's when there weren't dark ages. That's when advancements were made, because humans had time and energy to create, able to create in the arts and everywhere else.
Exactly. Humanity, up until really in the last 100 years, it was a hand-to-mouth existence, agricultural. Dominated society, relied on agricultural productivity, working the land. And so they were in the tough times, the colder periods. You had to devote your entire life and every waking moment to just survival. In the good times, which were associated with the other warm periods, again, food was bountiful. So that gave people the time to dream, to imagine, to invent. And that's what they did. We see all these great advancements of society taking place during these warming periods and then regressing during the cold periods. Cold periods went by the names of the Greek Dark Ages, the Dark Ages, and the Little Ice Age. And again, each of those cold periods were associated with just horrifically bad consequences for humanity. What's funny, Dr. Michael Mann, who was on trial, his trial just ended here in Washington, D.C., he's a climate scientist that's incorrectly stating that the warming trend that we're in today is unusual and unprecedented on the scale of thousands. And that there's nothing that can be further from the truth. And he was asked, what's the ideal temperature for the Earth? He said, that's easy. It's the temperature it was before we started adding carbon dioxide. If that's the case, that would put us directly in the horrifically cold temperatures of the Little Ice Age. Again, the Little Ice Age, 1850 to 1850, probably the coldest period in the last 10,000 years. I don't want that. I've recently moved to Florida. I like it warm. You know, we don't hear people are flocking to Texas, to Florida, to the South. You don't hear people talking about, I think I'm going to move to Wales, where it's cold and miserable most of the year. No, thank you. I like Florida. And again, agriculture loves warmer temperatures. I'm in the process of writing a book for our comic series, educational series. The first in a new series, title is Chloe the Clownfish Sleeps Well. And it's about Chloe, who was told by her teacher that the Great Barrier Reef was doomed and was going to be dead and her family would all die. And we take a look at that, and it's really interesting. There's all sorts of articles of bleaching and dying of the Great Barrier Reef. But the fact of the matter is, it's the coral cover of that reef is greater than it's been for the last 30 years since they started doing surveys. And the fact of the matter is, if you look at what's called the Coral Triangle, which is up north of Australia, around Indonesia and New Guinea, that water is 2 degrees Celsius, warmer than what it is at the Great Barrier Reef. And the corals love hot water, and they grow much faster. And there's a great correlation. I've got a chart that I've captured for this little book.
Correlation, Greg?
Relationship between hot water and coral growth.
Yes, yes. I'm sorry, I made a bad joke. Correlation sounded like coral-ation.
Oh, I like that. I might use that.
So, Greg, what is your opinion on the computerized climate models that are being developed, kind of IA-ish, and their reality?
Yeah, the climate models that are being used to drive policy decisions and to promote this horrifically bad idea of carbon capture and lowering of CO2 levels, we know that they overpredict warming. Dr. John Christie, in his work, shows that they overpredict warming 2.5 to 3 times too much. And they build these models, and they can tweak them to actually make the models do whatever they like. But if you look at actual measured temperature versus models, again, it's 2.5 to 3 times too warm. It's been said, you know, making predictions is pretty tough, especially about the future.
And Greg, in your mind, is there a biggest myth that you happen upon whenever you give talks, or perhaps if you're talking to someone you're sitting next to on a plane?
Well, that's pretty easy. It's that there's too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, when the truth is we're CO2 impoverished. We don't have too much CO2, we don't have enough. And people in green, that use the grow crops in greenhouses, they often double and triple the ambient CO2 levels up over 1,000 parts per million. And we'll continue benefiting even higher than that 1,000 parts per million. Again, we're at 400 today. So, yeah, that's the little known fact is, again, that we're actually too little CO2. We don't have too much.
Right. And just hearing you speak about the coldest temperatures in recent history and the little ice age and going up into 1850, people survived that. Were there less crops, perhaps? Was it colder? But it certainly was not a doom and gloom, everybody's gone.
The little ice age was pretty bad worldwide for people. And again, as much as a third of the population perished during that time. So the cold was not welcome,
right,
but the warmth is.
Many thanks to Gregory Wrightstone, author of A Very Convenient Warming. I'm Robin Clare at tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Thanks for staying tuned.